Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
Thanks to all of you who've pledged your support and made an investment in Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River. Today we focus on something all of us spend roughly a third of our lives doing, and how well we do this particular thing has a big impact on how the other two-thirds of our life goes. I'm talking about sleep, of course. Millions of Americans have trouble getting a good night's sleep. So this hour, we'll hear about some key problems that prevent us from sleeping and what can be done about it, along with some of the latest fascinating recent sleep research. We'll listen back to several excerpts of conversations with our regular guest, neurologist Dr. Eric Daikin. He's director of the University of Iowa Sleep Disorders Center. We start off by focusing on sleep apnea. How is sleep apnea diagnosed, Dr. Daikin?
When you have this combination of horrifically loud snoring, repeated arousals with gasping for breath, insomnia throughout the night, and despite the fact sleeping hours and hours and hours or attempting to, as she said, trying to, pathologically exhausted, sleepy, those big three, the horrific snoring, the insomnia, and the daytime sleepiness despite enough sleep are often the big three complaints that we hear about. If you add on other health-related problems, obesity, big tonsils in children, hypertension, cardiac disease, and maybe even stroke, those things sort of add to the formula.
Mm-hmm. So this is, sleep apnea is something just because maybe you have a 15-year-old at home, it could affect a young person as well?
We're having an obesity explosion in the United States. You know, it's a double-edged sword. Actually, some of the greatest times we're having now, despite all the economic and this and that. And my wife is a pediatric sleep expert, and we see children all the time. It's obesity explosion, where you gain weight a little bit in your stomach, your hips, etc. You can gain it in the back of your throat. Simple way of looking at it, of course. That, add a couple of tonsils. It gets heavy and relaxed in the middle of the night, and it closes off, and you have apnea even in children.
I wonder, once sleep apnea is diagnosed, what sort of treatments are available?
Well, you know, I had had the apnea. I lost a whole bunch of weight, 55 pounds, and praise the Lord, if I slept on my stomach, and we've talked about position. That's a positional therapy. Gravity pulled my airways open. And as the years went by, I woke up one day with visual loss in my right eye, and my weight was back up, and I went back to the lab. My apnea was worse, and I went on, now that I was failing my positional therapy, my weight loss therapy, I went back on the CPAP therapy, which was much better than it was 10 years ago. My son will now go on vacation with me because he doesn't have to hear the horrific snoring. Swear to God, I've tripped over him in the bathroom at Disneyland. Said, "What are you doing on the floor?" He goes, "Dad, I can't stand the snoring." So it's taking care of a couple problems, I think.
Mm-hmm. John is joining us from Cedar Falls. Hi, John. You have an experience with sleep apnea or something else?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I believe it's been about 10 years ago, I actually went through the sleep clinic with our good doctor, and it was prescribed to me that I needed a CPAP machine at the time. I had over several hundred interruptions of my sleep over the course of my sleeping pattern, and now that I've gotten older and I'm trying to be in less denial and follow up on a New Year's resolution, I decided I wanted to do something about it. I always thought it was rather unsexy, if you will, to sleep with a CPAP machine on in bed, and I'd heard about some clinic that offered a surgery to your throat that might alleviate the snoring, but I don't know if it also alleviates the apnea. I'm assuming it would, but I'd like to know more about that procedure rather than the alternative to wearing a CPAP machine.
Okay, John, thank you for that call. To make sure all of our listeners are on board, a CPAP machine does what, doctor?
Yeah, it's a continuous positive airway pressure. CPAP is what it stands for, and it's a small mask that is placed over the nose or over the nose and mouth, delivers a gentle column of air, acts as a stent to keep the airways open all the way from the nose to the lungs, and that's what I use. And it's a lot better than it used to be, and I think my machine's sexy. So anyway, so, I mean, there's no question there's a mindset that you said, a resolution. But the surgeries generally are about 15 to 40% at the best with correcting the sleep apnea, because sleep apnea can be due to a variety of reasons. And in some respects, the surgeons just can't get to all the tissue or predict all the tissue they would need to take out. I think in the future, we're going to have better and better surgeries. But right now, they're very, very good for snoring. The uvulopalatopharyngoplasty, and that's all Latin terms for the stuff in the back of your throat, the uvula, the thing hangs down the back of your throat, far side, you get 50 points, you get it right on the test, whatever. They just cut out the stuff that's flopping around, very good, and the treatment of choice for snoring. But again, insurance companies think that's cosmetic. I think they're wrong in that regard, but it's very, very good for the snoring, but does not always get the sleep apnea.
Okay, John in Cedar Falls, we wish you a good sleep, and let's move on to Nancy in Vinton. Your question, Nancy.
My son uses a CPAP machine, and he is 42 years old, and he's Down syndrome, and he is not keeping it on at night. It was suggested by his psychiatrist that he use a BiPAP. I would like to know the difference between the BiPAP and the CPAP and what you would recommend.
Nancy, thank you very much. Doctor, we have about a minute before a break. Go ahead.
Yeah, the CPAP is continuous pressure, and so when you breathe back out, you're breathing out against a small hurricane relative. The BiPAP, if you fail CPAP, and that's one thing the insurance people have to show, that you just cannot tolerate it, then you can go to the more expensive BiPAP machine that has a little computer chip that senses when you inspire. You're breathing with the flow. It gives you higher pressure on inspiration. Physiologically, that's what you need. Just trust me on that one. And when you breathe out, you usually need a lesser pressure, and it will sense that, and it will lower the pressure that you breathe out against, make it more comfortable. But sometimes for Down syndrome, and my wife runs a Down syndrome sleep apnea clinic, she's done a lot of research on that, sometimes making the condition a little bit more positive conditioning can help. Well, even people without Down syndrome, that attitude we allude to.
Okay, Nancy and Vinton, does that do it for you?
Well, yes, but we've just tried everything, and he's only keeping it on about an hour a night, and that is not doing it. And so I wondered if it would be worth trying the BiPAP.
Okay. Maybe so. And then you might want to stop by and get into my wife's clinic. Not to belittle the local doctor, they are the backbone of medicine, but she does have an extra specialty, especially with the Down syndrome population, with a lot of assistance that they might be able to offer.
Nancy in Vinton, thank you very much for your call. We wish you good luck there with your son.
This sleep research published within the last few weeks in Nature Neuroscience, the journal here, has to do with brain circuits, Dr. Daikin, and reading about this. Understand brain circuits control sleep-wake cycles and consciousness, but a lot of it is still a puzzle. According to this new research, researchers have identified the specific brain circuit that wakes us from sleep, and something that could have implications here. It sounds a bit complicated, but you're so good at explaining very complicated things in down-to-earth terms. I wonder if you can help us understand this discovery, this study, and why it's significant.
Yeah, and they oversimplify it to some extent, as you say, and that's the best way to start. And they've been using this biological technique called optogenetics. And they use light to control cells and living tissues, and in this case, typically neurons in brain areas that help control sleep onset and offset. And that starts with the hypothalamus and its interaction with the thalamus. So there's this biologic clock you see that you can stimulate with this technique to see what it does to the animal to make it wake up or go to sleep. And in this series of tests, they took mice, and with the circadian rhythm parts of the brain, they would stimulate it, and they could induce arousal, and if they would decrease the stimulation with light, it would be just like us, going to sleep. And they found a little circuit that follows the day-night schedule that we typically follow.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the implications for us as humans at some point? Does this tell us that we didn't know before?
Yeah. They've sort of localized a little bit more that biologic clock that is responsible for having you wake up and having you go to sleep. Now that they've localized it, they can look at the neurotransmitters, the chemicals intrinsic to these cells. And what they hope to do is in people who have problems with sleepiness
or insomnia, difficulty initiating or maintaining sleep, find what the chemical abnormality is within the circuit that they've localized, and then think of a good pharmaceutical, a medical, a drug-related treatment for people who may have had injury or abnormal circuits in their brain, the biologic clock.
Mm-hmm. Don't the medicines that we have for sleep trigger those chemical responses already, or we're sort of, to a certain extent, feeling around in the dark because we don't know, we don't understand completely the mechanisms at work?
It's interesting. There's a variety of things that can cause people to keep wide awake. Amphetamines are one, and there are a variety of chemicals and drugs that can cause a person to go to sleep. Benzodiazepines are another drug class that have been more and more focused on because we're getting better and better at localizing this center. So this center has led to the development of amphetamines to keep people awake. But again, there are side effects potentially with this drug if you don't eat it, and benzodiazepines, for example, to keep people asleep, but still with side effect. Wouldn't it be nice to get more and more to the core of this center, this biologic clock, and find a medicine without the side effects that we can see with amphetamines and, for example, an overdose of a sedative?
Mm-hmm. So this new research published in Nature Neuroscience, a step possibly in that direction which you're describing.
Necessity and safety.
Well, let's talk about what you just referred to, some dreaming, some scientists pinpointing what they call the brain's hot zone that is activated when we dream. Research showing recently that we dream even outside of REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. My understanding of the article is it goes against the previous consensus among sleep experts, neurologists, Dr. Daikin, that humans experience dreams only during REM sleep cycles. What do you make of this, that possibly outside of REM there are dreams?
Oh, we've always thought there's been dreams outside of REM sleep, but maybe not as good. So we know there's a stimulation and from the lower part of the brain, we call it the pons, to the geniculate nucleus, which is in the thalamus, to the occipital lobe. The occipital lobe is the hot zone that he's talking about. So part of dream is usual visual, and that's the visual part of the brain. So when we record brain waves, we usually do the EEG. You're really recording far from the generator source. So actually, dream sleep may be occurring much earlier than the recordings we pick up on an electroencephalogram or an EEG. So you might have these processes low in the brain, active, even though you're not recording them. So that's a phenomena that we've alluded to for years. But this brings it a little bit more into the public's eye. And that's sort of neat. And they show that in the dreams in non-REM sleep, where you generally aren't expected to have dreams, they're not as well formed as the dreams in REM sleep. But they both excite this hot spot in the occipital lobe, the vision area of the brain. The ones that you tend to remember, though, not only excite, it's implied, the hot spot, the occipital lobe, but also an area of the brain called the prefrontal cortex. So it's implicit that the dreams you remember are exciting not only the back of the brain, the hot zone, the occipital lobe, the vision area, but also the memory encoding area in the prefrontal cortex. Sort of cool.
Very cool.
Yeah.
This hour, we're listening back to excerpts from our regular sleep news and research shows with Dr. Eric Daikin, a neurologist and director of the University of Iowa Sleep Disorders Center. Well, when we come back, we'll hear about some more fascinating research, some new research on how poor sleep may have a connection with Alzheimer's later in life. Also, when we come back, how we perceive noise while we sleep, and how treatment for sleep apnea has been changing. That's after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Welcome back to this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're hearing about some key problems that prevent us from sleeping and what can be done about it, along with some of the latest sleep research. We're listening back to several excerpts of conversations with our regular guest, neurologist Dr. Eric Daikin. He's director of the University of Iowa Sleep Disorders Center. And a few times a year, as many of you know, we ask him to come into our studio to comment on the latest sleep research in the news and also to answer your questions. from the University of California in Berkeley. Scientists there have found some compelling evidence that poor sleep, particularly a deficit in this deep, deep restorative sleep, is believed to trigger Alzheimer's disease attacks with the brain's long-term memory. Looking at this is in the Nature Neuroscience, the journal. UC Berkeley neuroscience professor Matthew Walker, the senior author of the study, says, "Our findings reveal a new pathway through which Alzheimer's disease may cause memory decline later in life." You've read through this study. What do you see? What is the connection? What are we seeing emerge? Because I know there are related studies between Alzheimer's and poor sleep.
Yeah, it's sort of the chicken or the egg, a cause and effect. So it's interesting material. We know in a variety of the dementias, whether it's Alzheimer-like or multi-infarct dementia or Parkinson-related dementias, there's a degeneration of multiple areas in the brain, including sleep-related centers. So you get this domino effect that you need sleep for restoration, essentially. And if you're getting poor sleep, especially if there's degeneration of normal sleep waking centers, then it can just make itself worse and worse and worse. And in this study, what they've seen in animals is that in the slow wave sleep or non-REM, non-rapid eye movement sleep, non-dreaming sleep, that maybe there's a reduction of the size of cells in the brain, the hippocampus and the frontal cortex. And this allows for extracerebral spinal fluid to sort of wash away what they call beta amyloid, which tends to accumulate in Alzheimer-like dementia. So preventive medicine, if you can, as a young person and throughout your life, tremendously work on getting good levels of sleep routinely, then you may wash away that element of beta amyloid for the long run and help for longevity, better morbidity, reduced mortality, morbidity, et cetera. So a lot of speculation, but some interesting finding.
And also so offers the possibility, as we find out more, that that this is poor sleep can be made better and perhaps improve dementia symptoms. Are we that far in seeing that or not?
I think so, and we've talked about cognitive behavioral therapeutic interventions, the big long Latin term, if you will, for good sleep hygiene. As we get older, and if we're retired or if we're in a care facility, oftentimes we're not getting the best sleep-wake schedule. We're often napping all day, not sleeping at night, having the sundowning, if you will, where we're confused and sometimes having to have medications to calm us down at night. And there's a reversal of the sleep-wake pattern that is normal. We're supposed to sleep at night and be awake during the day. And it can just be sort of a spiral if you don't aggressively address basic elements of, for example, sleep restriction. We've talked about that. Keeping awake and active during the day, exercising the brain with checkers or chess, and then saving sleep for the most part for the night, for the restoration that is implicit by these studies that we've talked about with Alzheimer's.
Let's talk about a new – you work for the University of Iowa. This is a different part of the University of Iowa that is doing this, not really to do with your sleep disorders center, but the University of Iowa has started to train eligible employees at no cost to sleep more soundly using a computer-based program called ShutEye. That's the acronym, Sleeping Healthy Using the Internet. That's what that's short for, ShutEye. And it's based on the principles, it says, of cognitive behavioral treatment for insomnia, 6 to 8 week online program. Describe the approach that ShutEye takes.
Well, you know, it is a great program that I had no idea existed until somebody from the Cedar Rapids Gazette said, "What is this great program they have at the University of Iowa through the UI Employee Assistance Program?" This Maggie Moore has this cognitive behavioral therapeutic intervention course that I guess was thought up at the University of Virginia, where over a 6 to 8 week period, they really tailor make it to the specific kind of insomnia that you have. And it's implicit that if you have severe sleep apnea, narcolepsy, a variety of other sleep-related problems, or you're a nighttime worker, that's not really what this program is for. It's for the typical you and me, 24 hours a day, we're under stress and pressure. How do we try to keep awake during the day and get good, solidified, consolidated sleep at night? And I guess what they've did is they had a pilot program, and they offered this to a variety of different employees and staff people at the University of Iowa who had the right kind of insomnia. And over a 6 to 8 week period, 1 week at a time, they address a specific standard of this cognitive behavioral therapeutic intervention, which includes subtopics of sleep restriction, stimulus control, cognitive restructuring, and general sleep education for relapse protection.
Let's talk about a couple of those terms that we may not know well.
Big words.
Cognitive restructuring. What is cognitive restructuring when it comes to sleep?
Well, it's really interesting. In fact, one of my colleagues had talked to one of his patients. Now, keeping a good sleep diary, knowing what you're about, is sort of like if you're in a weight loss program, knowing how many calories you had in a day. For a person with a problem with insomnia, when are you sleeping? When are you napping? How long are you sleeping? When's your bedtime? When's your awakening time? So knowing what you're about, and then knowing what is normal. Many of us, most of us, on a bell-shaped curve, need 7 to 9 hours of sleep over a 24-hour period. Some of us don't know that. Some of us think we can train ourselves to get by with 5 hours of sleep, 4 hours of sleep. So an awful lot of this cognitive behavior is knowing what is normal, knowing how what is normal sleep fits into what your normal day is, and then tailor-making what is normalcy for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about sleep restriction? In what cases would you want to restrict sleep to improve your sleep?
Well, have you ever just laid in bed for hours and hours and counted the sheep, and then you thought about, you know, my kids are going to college, graduate school, and then mom and dad are getting older, and how much money do we really, what if I died tomorrow, and the dogs get, and I love that cat, and oh my God. And then you start thinking, and you're thinking, and you're thinking. So sometimes you can stay in bed too long. And we know that if you do stay in bed too long, that that can be a negative condition. And just like Pavlov's dog, a steak and the bell, you ring a bell 1,000 times, you show the dog the steak, and after a while you can throw away the steak, ring the bell, and the dog's going to slobber. You can make the bedroom very uninviting. You lay there hour after hour, night after night, whatever it might be, and you can make your bed the Pavlov's dog without the steak, and it can be a negative thing for you. So sleep restriction often is sleeping in the bed, staying in bed just as long as you need to. Well, the first night I only got 5 hours of sleep. Well, then you wake up, and then you do not nap during the day. In this specific case, now naps might not be bad in some individuals. Not in this case, no nap. So by the time 10 o'clock, 9:30, whenever you go to bed runs around, you only got 5 hours of sleep. I'm pretty tired. Well, but I'm still thinking about that dog and the cat. And okay, you have some trouble getting to sleep this night. You got another night of 5 hours. And you don't sleep the next 24 hours, and by the time it finally catches up with you, you're going to pass out, and you're going to sleep deep and solidly because of general sleep restriction. Now, that's a simple approach. It doesn't work for everyone, but in some cases, it might be the way to break the cycle of negative conditioning in the bedroom environment.
Mm-hmm. University of Iowa started training eligible employees at no cost to sleep more soundly through this program, through the University of Virginia's program, I believe. Dr. Dykin, do you see this as a trend, employers becoming more interested in how well employees sleep?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Riverside Casino, I might as well mention them. I don't ever really work at the casino, but they had us come and talk to them many years ago. The owner has people who work 7 days a week, 24 hours, and they're going home after being up all night, driving very, very sleepy, and we know that people fall asleep, including residents and doctors and people who work overnight at Hy-Vee because they're sleepy, they're fighting Mother Nature, and that's a big deal. And if you fall asleep driving in a car, it may be the last time you fall asleep. So you want your workers to be healthy, And there is some self-serving to it. You are more productive, you're happier, quality of life for the managerial level and for the employee. And absolutely. And what a great thing. And it's such a surprise. I didn't even know we had the program. And a lot of the other doctors at our graduate medical education meeting of last week didn't know this program was availed either. And I think we're just pleasantly surprised that these things are going on, and I think they will continue to improve.
Let's talk, Dr. Daikin, broadly about noise, sound, and sleep. In 1978, our then Surgeon General declared something of a war on noise. He said noise must be considered a hazard to the health of people everywhere. He says calling noise a nuisance is like calling smog an inconvenience. So let's talk a little bit about that. We know about noise during our waking period, but what happens to our perception of noise, our brain activity, how we perceive noise when we slip into the state of slumber?
Well, first you got to start with the definition of noise. And my thought is, and that's where a lot of these studies and a lot of these reports really fall apart, because what is noise to my ears may be a lullaby to anybody else's ears. We were in a band, and I remember in undergrad, the rock and roll was blaring, and it got me to sleep. I just smiled, and even back then I said, I can deal with this, it's great, but my parents would go absolutely crazy. Also, if that beautiful noise during the day is welcome during the day, but it comes in at 2 or 3 in the morning, it may become noise at night, beautiful music during the day. So it's implicit that there are certain environments, not just the noise, but the light, the darkness, the temperature. Have you eaten? Are you starving? Do you have stresses and pressure? Your sleep hygiene is all together at the normal circadian time for sleep at the night. So again, even a loud noise, a pleasant noise, may become unwelcome at night. We've talked about the pink noise, the white noise, the brown noise, these different frequencies, different decibels of noise. Some things are soothing. And for somebody, a Brahms lullaby might get them to sleep or their baby asleep. A Rolling Stone song might do it for some of us. But there are some generalisms. And when talking about the white noise, this fuzzy sound in the background.
Well, I think we even have some white noise. Let's see if we do listen to some white noise. You mentioned people are, I think, familiar with white, but there's also pink and brown, as you mentioned. Let's listen to some white noise at first and get acquainted with that. Okay, let's go. Let's hear some of that. Okay, so describe that.
I think it's just a masking. It's implicit. And I remember one of my roommates in undergrad, he would have white noise on every night because we were all studying at different time, and then he couldn't hear us. So it masks out. It provided a consistency. I think he conditioned to that consistency, and it didn't wake him up. Nothing else intervened.
Mm-hmm. Let's try some pink noise. Here's some pink noise. Okay, a slight difference there. If you're driving around in your car, you might not hear it, but what is the difference there?
Could you hear the waves? That's what I heard. I heard the waves, and I found it very inviting. But any individual, and especially if you lived in the hurricane, that might have been horrific noise for you. But I found it very pleasant and different from the white noise.
Let's move onto the spectrum, into the brown noise spectrum. Okay.
Oh, boy, I thought I saw, what are those straight-line wind, one-mile tornado thing getting ready to... But I think it could be interpreted to me in different ways.
Let's talk a little bit. When we sleep, we shut our eyes. Mm. Unless we have earplugs, we can't shut our ears. Nature didn't make us that way. Also, we want to be able to sense things in our environment with our eyes closed. So they're there. They're active. The brain doesn't turn off its perception of sound. What happens?
Well, actually, when you get into this quote-unquote deep stage of sleep that you were referring to, REM sleep, rapid eye movement, dreaming sleep, good friends of ours from Harvard, Hobson and McCarley, actually indicated that your visual cortex, the part of your brain that incorporates seeing things, is highly active. So think of your dreams. Three major things occur in most of our dreams. Our visual system is elevated, not turned off. Our middle ear muscle activity is elevated, so hearing is a normal part of most people's dreams. And number three, the movement centers. Although we're paralyzed, they're almost elevated to the point of paralysis, they are excited so that the dream component is often vision, auditory, and movement. And if you're sleeping, the brain doesn't like cacophony, which means all these different noises going back and forth. Hobson and McCarley say, according to the isomorphism postulate, big word there, Latin, that you'll hear it and you might incorporate it into your dream if it's pleasant enough. But if the decibel's too loud or if it's noxious enough, it may wake you up. So there is a very active brain that may actually incorporate those happy sounds, if they're happy, persistent dream. Too loud, too noxious, wake you up.
Let's talk about a general trend that you've identified here and that's happening not only here in Iowa with your sleep clinic center and across the nation, that we've talked so often about CPAPs. This is a short way of saying continuous positive airway pressure machine. And this is given to people who have sleep, are diagnosed with sleep apnea. They have a problem getting enough oxygen when they're sleeping. The airflow is not working. So this machine to treat obstructive sleep apnea is a small machine that provides some pressure.
Right.
And you sleep and it has a mask on it. Now, as those have been around a few years, tell us how the treatment with CPAP machines has been changing the thinking, because I know there are some new findings there.
Well, some of the things we've used, there's the typical person with obstructive sleep apnea, like me, where the airway's a little bit crowded and heavy, and this continuous positive airway pressure acts as a stent to keep the airways open from the tip of my nose down to my lungs. Now, there are specific cases of people, for example, with heart failure, which is very common. Number one cause of death in the world is heart disease, heart attacks. So people in heart failure will often have a different kind of sleep apnea, maybe some obstructions, but actually central sleep apnea in the form of what we call Shane-Stoke respirations, where they'll just stop breathing and then they'll breathe fast and they'll stop breathing and they'll breathe fast. There's a specific machine we've used for heart failure called adaptive servoventilation that can pick up the pace for them when they're not breathing, in addition to acting as a stent to keep the airways open. But we've recently seen if that pressure is too high, in a heart that's failing, it can reduce the return of blood from the extremities to the heart and can actually be deadly in certain people with stage 4 heart failure or a reduction in the ejection fraction. And it's sort of the hot topic over the last year where we're very careful on how we apply the use of PAP, positive airway pressure therapies. And in fact, it's very timely. This Thursday, we speak downtown for the respiratory therapist group specifically about this topic.
Is aside from heart conditions, are there other conditions that you take into account when prescribing a CPAP machine and treatment that you dial into the formula, whereas maybe in previous years you would have, you know, as our knowledge was not, the knowledge base was not so great, that you would have not considered?
Well, Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and the kids with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, they tend to hypoventilate, and as their disease progresses, and it will, they often are pooping out, hypoventilating, if you will, at night even more than during the day. And we have a specific kind of a PAP machine, positive airway pressure machine, called AVAPS, and it's average volume assured ventilatory support, pressure support. And we have to address that very specifically in regard to what we call a tidal volume, which we can set, and the amount of pressure we give. Because blowing out against a small hurricane, this pressure head can actually poop them out. But when it's applied appropriately, it can add months to their lives. It may not be years, but again, we're hoping for prolonging the quality and the duration of people with neuromuscular diseases like that.
There are no doubt thousands of people listening right now who, hundreds if not thousands, listening who do use the CPAP machines. Now, depending on where they got, can they be confident that that these factors were taken into account no matter they saw their primary care or a sleep specialist across Iowa, at your clinic, obviously, at your center, obviously. But do I guess I'm asking people now with CPAP machines listening to this conversation, do they need to ask extra questions or do any follow-up there if they're concerned?
Well, always buyer beware kind of a thing. Be aware that this is a branch of medicine in its relative infancy. And in fact, we saw one neuromuscular case over the last month. Only 100 of them exist in the world. And to my knowledge, this was the first time we used the specific kind of a PAP support in any case. So as you've implied, the patient becomes part of, well, they are part of the team, the number one part of the team. They need to ask questions. We need to translate things simply, straightforward, in a palatable, easy to understand fashion, knowing that we're really not dealing with that simple of a process.
This hour, we've been listening back to excerpts from our regular conversations with neurologist Dr. Eric Daikin, director of the University of Iowa Sleep Disorders Center. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. Of course, we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.